Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a microscopic look at, well, at the literal foundation of modern industry. High-strength, low-alloy steels, you'll hear them called HSLA steels. And these are the materials used when failure is just not an option. I mean, we're talking about the guts of deep-sea offshore platforms, high-pressure pipelines.
All those massive infrastructure projects in really unforgiving environments.
Exactly.
And, you know, while the steel itself is impressive, the real engineering challenge so often lies in the connection, how you weld these critical components together.
Right.
Fusion welding is, I mean, it's one of the broadest and most technically demanding fields in all of metallurgy. There's this constant push for better, safer, tougher structures. And that means engineers are always demanding more from the weld than from the parent material itself.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Our mission today is to analyze a really foundational piece of research, a rigorous, deeply technical PhD dissertation from 1982 that goes deep inside the metal structure. We're going to try and synthesize some complex metallurgical data into clear, usable knowledge for you, because when we look inside that weld seam, the secret to ultimate strength and toughness, it lies in controlling one specific crystal structure.
That's it.
We are hunting for the perfect recipe for what metallurgists call a secular ferret. So if you need a weld to hold up an oil rig in the, I don't know, the freezing North Sea, what exactly makes that tiny seam of metal so incredibly strong? It all comes down to the microscopic structure that forms as it cools. What is this acicular ferret, and why is it our hero?
Well, acicular ferret, or AF, is the absolute gold standard for this kind of application for HSLA steel weld metals.
Okay.
The word acicular literally means needle-like, and what makes it superior is its physical shape and arrangement. It forms this dense, fine-grained, highly interlocking network.
So think less like simple stacked bricks.
And more like a complex three-dimensional truss structure.
Yeah. So it's not just strong, it's organized to resist fracture.
Precisely. That interlocking morphology means that any crack trying to propagate through the material, it has to constantly change direction.
Which takes energy.
It uses up energy, exactly.
Yeah.
And this microstructure has been shown again and again to be intrinsically stronger and tougher than other common structures, ones that tend to form along the weaker grain boundaries.
So when researchers publish findings on the mechanical properties of these welds, what they're really doing is publishing a study of how to create more acicular ferrite.
That's the game.
It sounds simple, but I'm guessing it's not. The central challenge of this original investigation was figuring out exactly which factors controlled the amount of AF in the final deposit.
And it's anything but simple. The factors are complex, and they're highly interrelated. The research ultimately boiled it down to four primary control mechanisms that govern how much acicular ferrite you get.
Okay, what are they?
First, you have the cooling rate of the weld, which dictates how fast atoms have to move.
Makes sense.
Second is the overall alloy composition, so what elements are actually present. Third, the content of nonmetallic inclusions. And fourth, the original austenite grain size that everything forms from. Getting those four variables to align is the entire job.
That list leads us right into the most, I think, counterintuitive part of this whole deep dive, because here's where it gets really interesting. When we talk about high-performance materials, we usually assume purity is power. We want to get rid of impurities, these inclusions.
Right, non-metallic particles.
But in high-strength steel-walled metals, the research proved the relationship is, well, it's a paradox. You actually need impurities.
You absolutely do. This was the fundamental breakthrough of this whole line of research. They found that certain inclusions, things like manganese sulfide or silicates, are actually beneficial.
Beneficial how?
They're essential. They serve as a kind of physical scaffolding. Mm-hmm. That they're the primary sites for what's called the intergranular nucleation of acicular ferrite.
Okay, break that down. So if the steel is cooling, where does this new tough AF structure start to form?
Well, if the steel were perfectly clean, new, weaker ferrite structures would all start forming along the boundaries of the large, high-temperature grains. Mm. And that creates weak spots.
I see.
But the inclusion, it acts as a tiny pre-existing template, a seed crystal, if you like, inside the larger grain. It provides a low-energy interface. It essentially tricks the cooling steel into starting the AF structure internally, creating that tough interlocking web we want.
Instead of the weak boundary structure you want to avoid.
Exactly.
So trying to make the steel too clean is actually self-defeating. You lose your seeds. That runs completely counter to intuition.
It really does. The research, and it was citing earlier work by Ito and Nakanishi, detailed what they called the oxygen effect.
Mm-hmm.
You see, oxygen content is often used as a proxy for the total volume of these non-metallic inclusions.
Yep.
And they discovered that toughness does not continuously increase as inclusion content drops to zero. Instead, there is a clear optimum inclusion volume fraction for maximum toughness.
And I imagine hitting that sweet spot in a real industrial setting is incredibly challenging. You're trying to manage a necessary impurity.
It is an act of extreme metallurgical precision. For submerged arc welds, they found this optimum was linked to a medium oxygen regime, around 0.03% OUR.
Can you put that in context?
Sure. If you look at standard wrought steel, any increase in inclusions generally decreases toughness, straight line down. But in the submerged arc weld metal they studied, there was this dramatic peak of toughness right around 300 parts per million of oxygen. Go higher or lower, and toughness just drops off.
So it's a bell curve. Too dirty, it's weak. Too clean, it's also weak. And I'm guessing it's not just the amount of inclusions that matters, but their characteristics, right?
Yeah, absolutely critical. The inclusion size distribution itself is vital for how the weld will fracture, whether it's a ductile failure or a brittle cleavage failure. I don't want to get lost in the numbers, but the data here is just fascinating. The investigation compared two specific welds, SA4 and SA1.
And SA4 was the tougher one.
Right. It achieved its superior performance, partly because it had smaller, more evenly spaced inclusions.
Can you give us a sense of that size difference?
So weld SA4 had a smaller average inclusion size, 0.39 micrometers, which is tiny. Weld SA1, the lower toughness sample, had a larger average size, 0.46 micrometers, even though it actually had a higher number of total inclusions.
Wow.
Which proves that size and distribution are more important than just sheer density. The inclusions have to be small enough and spread out enough to start those AF structures without becoming big failure points themselves.
So we know the goal is this interlocking acicular ferrite. We know it's catalyzed by these precise small inclusions. What does this all mean on the factory floor for someone actually making the material for a pipeline?
It means total control over the raw chemistry.
It has to.
Yeah. The investigation pinpointed these optimal ranges for several key alloying elements, particularly in submerged arc welds, because these elements directly influence which structures form and how the inclusions themselves behave.
Okay, let's start with the one everyone associates with steel strength, carbon.
And carbon, paradoxically, is generally detrimental to getting that optimal combo of toughness and strength.
Really?
The research showed that increasing carbon from just 0.1% to 0.19% significantly reduced the material's impact properties.
Why is that?
Because higher carbon levels dramatically increase the risk of forming brittle, non-AF microstructures, things like martensite or high carbon bainite when it cools.
It's a balancing act then. You need strength, but not the brittleness. So what elements help you keep the toughness?
That's where the stabilizers come in. Silica is essential, but it has a really tight optimum range for toughness, between 0.2 and 0.4%. Go above that, and it starts becoming detrimental.
Promoting the wrong structures.
Exactly. Manganese is another key player. It helps stabilize the correct phases, and it showed an optimum range of 0.4 to 1.4%. And finally, molybdenum proved to be highly beneficial, with an optimum level around 0.3% for the best toughness improvement.
And these aren't just arbitrary numbers.
Not at all. They are the chemical boundaries of success.
The level of control they needed in the lab to isolate these effects is just astonishing. I mean, this was a 1982 PhD thesis, but the techniques they were using were incredibly high-tech for the time.
They had to be. They needed to isolate the variables, especially the cooling rate, from the chemistry. So they used commercial methods like submerged arc welding, or SAW, for large deposits, and also manual metal arc welding, MA, with specific low-hydrogen electrodes, the E7016 and E7018 types, which are very common in industry.
But they had to go even further than that to understand the physics of the cooling, didn't they?
Exactly. To study microstructures that form under really fast cooling, they used electron beam welding, EB welding, which gives you this intense, focused heat.
And very fast dissipation.
Right. But the real game changer for collecting their data was the TIG remelting and quenching procedure.
Why was that specific procedure so necessary?
Because they needed real empirical data on how fast the metal was actually cooling. They would melt these small sections using TIG welding and then immediately quench the deposit in iced brine. and they had internal thermocouples to measure the thermal history with incredible precision.
So they had a fingerprint of the cooling process.
That's a great way to put it. It showed they could control and measure cooling from 1200 degrees Celsius down to 300 degrees, the critical range for these transformations, in as little as 4 seconds. That precise thermal fingerprint was essential.
Understanding the chemistry and the cooling rate, it all brings us back to the core physics of the steel itself. When the steel is first molten, or even when it's just red hot, its initial structure is called austenite.
A very uniform structure.
Yeah, right. And the way this austenite breaks down as it cools, its decomposition, is, I mean, it's arguably the single most important phase transformation in all of physical metallurgy.
When austenite cools, it changes into the final microstructure. And the speed and method of cooling dictates what you get.
So if it cools slowly?
You might get protactoid ferrite, which is weak and forms at the grain boundaries. If it cools moderately, you get our target, acicular ferrite, or structures like bainite. If it cools extremely fast, you get martensite.
And martensite is famously hard.
Oh, yeah. Martensite forms through a sudden shear-based transformation. It's extremely hard, but it's usually very brittle, like glass. Acicular ferrite and bainite, those are the ones that give you that perfect combo of strength and toughness.
Now, the formation of these structures, specifically Widmanstätten ferrite and bainite, this was a huge scientific battleground when this thesis was written.
It was.
It boiled down to whether the transformation was driven by atoms physically moving around or if it was more like a sudden physical shift.
That's right. The great debate was diffusional versus displacive. The diffusional school argued that the growth of these new structures was controlled by carbon atoms physically moving or diffusing out of the way.
Allowing things to rearrange over time.
Exactly.
And the opposing displacive school, what did they argue?
They argued that the transformation happened via a sudden shear mechanism, a lot like how martensite forms. It's a rapid physical shift, a change in shape. And crucially, this implies minimal or even zero diffusion of the heavier alloying elements, manganese, silicon, molybdenum. The atoms essentially just snap into a new position without chemically separating.
That seems like a massive theoretical difference. It changes your whole model.
Yeah.
So what was the key contribution of this 1982 research?
Well, the source material provided really critical experimental evidence supporting the displacive subunit mechanism for bainite formation. It really moved the field forward. And they were able to back it up with sophisticated thermodynamic analysis. The evidence included observing surface relief on their prepared samples, which is a classic signature of a shear transformation.
And they had a definitive piece of evidence, didn't they? That one thing that really proved it was shear, not slow diffusion.
They did. It was the detection of retained austenite. Using X-ray diffraction, they observed up to 1.5% retained austenite in one of the weld samples.
And why is that so important?
Because a purely diffusional transformation, it shouldn't leave any behind. The fact that the parent phase, the austenite, remained trapped in these little pockets confirms the transformation happened rapidly, by shear. There just wasn't enough time for all the atoms to fully rearrange. That small percentage of retained austenite was basically the smoking gun. It helped settle a major decades-old controversy. #outro.
So this deep dive has taken us from the high-pressure world of offshore engineering right down to the movement of individual atoms inside a cooling weld. To summarize the key takeaways, getting maximum performance in these high-strength welds relies entirely on creating that tough interlocking web of acicular ferrite.
And that structure is, counterintuitively, engineered not through absolute purity, but through the precise active management of controlled impurities, those small, well-distributed non-metallic inclusions that act as internal nucleation sites.
Which means you have to hit those tight chemical boundaries for elements like manganese, silicon, and molybdenum.
It really shows that engineering toughness is a true balancing act between purity, structure, and speed.
This deep dive demonstrates that engineering strength isn't just about mixing ingredients. It's about controlling microscopic nucleation sites and just nailing the precise thermal history, that cooling rate, to steer the steel toward the toughest microstructure.
Mm.
In metallurgy, we see this fantastic example where the imperfection, that necessary inclusion, is sometimes the deliberate solution.
And if we connect this back to the bigger picture, to real-world scale, we saw how the researchers had to work so hard just to control the cooling rate in the lab. Cooling down from 1200 degrees in about 4 seconds. So this raises an important question for you to consider. If that thermal history is so incredibly critical for forming acicular ferrite, how do modern massive structures like multipass welds that are 25 millimeters thick or more, which take hours, maybe even days, to fully cool, How do they ensure the maintenance of this fine, tough microstructure across the entirety of that massive weld volume? That scalability of cooling control is the ultimate industrial challenge that metallurgists still face today.